we were discussing the phases of the Z2 lattice gauge theory. So let me go over it again, because it was a bit too quick, and there are other features that I need to discuss. So we have that our Hamiltonian for the Z2 theory is this one. And we saw that under duality, and duality is this transformation where we call mu 3 of P, we call it BP, whereas we call mu 1 of P with an index nu that tells us the direction, the string of sigma x up to the placket P. So under duality, this becomes the Hamiltonian of the quantumizing in 2D, namely minus J mu 1 and mu 1 and mu 3. Okay. Mu 1 of P minus G sum over P and nu of mu 3 P mu 3 P plus nu. Okay. So we have the following situation. So we have G large and G small. Okay. And let me sketch what happens for the quantumizing 2D and for the Z2 theory. Okay. So for G large, we have the symmetry breaking phase, right? It's the one where the Ising term prevails. So it's the symmetry breaking or ferromagnetic. Whereas in these variables, G large means this term large. So in the Z2 theory, here we have the paramagnet. And what happens is the following, that in the new variables, because there is symmetry breaking, the expectation value of mu 3 is different from 0. So we have spontaneous magnetization of the mu 3 variable. But when we translate this object in the Z2 language, we see that it is this string, so this non-local object, to be different from 0. This is the object that creates an excitation or a kink. So this is called the disorder parameter, or the fact that it's different from 0 is called kink condensation. Very well. For G small, in the mu variables, we have the paramagnet. Whereas for the Z2 theory, G small means we have this phase, okay? And we don't know yet exactly what are all the features of this phase, but definitely the ground state for is fourfold degenerate. And this degeneracy depends on the topology, so we want to call it topological phase. Whereas here in the paramagnet, the ground state is unique. Very well. Okay, so what happens to correlation functions? So yesterday, so notice that in the Z2 language, all the correlation functions, 2 points correlation functions with the sigma z, are zero because these are not Genge invariant quantities. So the only objects that we can compute correlation functions over are the sigma x's. Okay? And so in order to understand what are the correlation functions of the sigma x's, let's look at the particular correlation function in the mu variables, and it is this one. It would be mu3 p plus nu, mu3 q plus nu, this correlation function. Okay? And we are looking at this correlation function in for G small. Okay, notice that this is a local operator, right? That is a local operator that has a diameter 2, but it's a local operator. And this is another local operator. Okay, so this is based at P and this is based at Q. And we are in a phase that is the paramagnet that has a unique ground state with a gap. So these correlation functions have to decay as P minus Q over some correlation length. Okay, so this is the object that I wanted to write at the end of last lecture.
Question?
Yeah.
What is nu?
Nu is this object here.
Yeah.
So in the mapping, it is a way to tell us. So we have the plaquette, and the next plaquette is plus nu. And when nu is x, is this one. When nu is y, is this one.
Okay.
Right. So I'm coupling nearby plaquettes in this way. So nu moves me in the dual lattice in the vertical or horizontal direction. But what is mu 3 times mu 3 at a site after? Well, remember, it is just sigma x, because it's the usual trick that we do xxx up to a certain p, and then xxxxxx up to the next one, because we have plus nu. So they all cancel, and we are left with 1x. So this would be a sigma x at the site, at the link I corresponding at the link between these two plaquettes that we can call I. And this one would be the one between the plaquettes q and q plus nu that we can call j. And the difference between I and j is exactly p minus q. So you see that this correlation length, these correlation functions decay also exponentially. So you see that in the Z2 theory, all the correlation functions are either identically zero because they are non-gauge invariant quantities, or when it's a paramagnet, they have to decay exponentially. And when it's a topological phase, they still have to decay exponentially. So the full Z2 theory looks like a disordered system. There is a quantum phase transition in between, because there is a quantum phase transition between these two phases. So if the gap closes in here through the mapping, also in these variables has to close. But it is apparently a quantum phase transition between two disordered phases. And this is how this thing was regarded until the late 90s. Okay? Because people were so, it was so ingrained in the mind of people that we can only consider order the non-vanishing of the expectation value of a local order parameter, that because in the Z2 theory, this doesn't happen, then, you know, there is no order whatsoever. Okay? So if you keep defining order as just there is an observable that is local, that has spontaneously a non-vanishing expectation value, then also the lattice gauge theory is not ordered. However, it has some interesting feature. And so far, the most interesting feature is that the degeneracy of the ground state is 2 to the 2g, where this g is the genus of the surface. Okay? So we have a topologically degeneracy. People completely overlooked this fact. Second remark that I want to make is in this mapping, when we do this mapping, we have fixed W1 and W2, our other topological degrees of freedom, to be plus one. And of course, it is the same if you do it plus minus one, plus one, plus one, minus one, minus one, minus one. But, well, then one could complain and say, the fact that in this topological phase, everything decays is, well, you know, is an artifact of the fact that you are considering only one state. Then there is a gap, then of course everything has to decay exponentially. I would not even have to use this argument, right? I have placed myself in one sector, there is only one ground state, there is a gap, then we know things have to decay exponentially. So let's say that we call the degenerate states psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, psi 4. Then nobody forbids me to define psi plus, for instance, as 1 over the square root of 2, the coherent superposition of psi 1 and psi 2. Okay? So, what happens in this state? What happens if I consider the correlation functions in this state? We know that when we do that with the ground states, with the symmetry breaking ground states, then we find long range order. Right? So, what happens here? Okay. So, what I would like to do is to be bold and consider a coherent superposition of these two different states and compute correlation functions of any observables in those states, right? Because if there must be some long-range fluctuations, it can only come between the superposition of these different states, right? If we find that correlation functions do not decay, then somehow these states are pretty much like symmetry broken states. But it's kind of the same thing. I have a degeneracy. When I make a superposition of these degenerate states, my correlation functions do not decay. So we would like to compute this thing. In Psi plus, we want to take some observable base at I times some observable base at J and compute this object. And let's say that this expectation value is something like, let me call it alpha square. Notice that if I write OI in the basis of psi 1 and psi 2, and I forget about the other basis vectors, I will have some diagonal elements and some other off-diagonal elements, alpha and alpha star. And this alpha square is exactly what comes from here. So this is always true. When I have correlation, long-range correlation functions, it's because your observable couples the two different states that are in psi plus. If you remember the symmetry broken example, we had 0, 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1, 1, 1 over square root of 2. And my sigma z on every site I would send me to the other one, all 0, 0 minus 1, 1, 1 over square root of 2. So you see, the off-diagonal element in this basis of sigma z is 1. I'm coupling them, and that's why sigma I times sigma j is different from 0. OK, so this is an important remark. To know whether this number is big or small, it all depends on how OI couples to these two different states. So let's keep that in mind. For now, I'm not saying how big this number is. In fact, we will show that it is very small. And that's why we didn't lose anything in saying, oh, everything decays exponentially. Because I will argue that this coupling alpha square is much smaller than that other number. So in the end, I can claim all correlation functions decay exponentially in the topological phase. But in order to do that, we need to show that alpha square is a small number, OK? So a third remark is the fact that alpha square is small is related to another very important fact. So we say that the degeneracy is robust. Okay? Now imagine I perturb my model. Okay? Like here, I switch on G. So we know that these four states are exactly degenerate for G equals 0. What happens when I perturb the model and I switch on G? So these four states that have the same energy Do I split this degeneracy? Or not? So usually, what do you expect that happens in perturbation theory? You introduce a perturbation, and the degeneracy split. However, when is that the degeneracy is not split by a perturbation? Yes, so there is a symmetry argument, right? So why do you have a degeneracy to start with? Because the Hamiltonian commutes with some operators. Our operators are these W operators, namely the WX axis. Well, then one could say, oh, you see, this operator actually does commute with this W axis, so I cannot expect this perturbation to split my degeneracy, right? Okay. But what if I introduced something else? Well, here we cannot really do that because we are constrained by this gauge theory. We can only use gauge invariant operators. So this theory is a little bit too constrained, and it's also a bit weird because our Hilbert space is non-local. So that's why all these interesting properties of the gauge theory, like this degeneracy and the fact that it is something in between, I mean, it's a disordered when you look at correlation functions and expectation values of local parameters. But it is not just a paramagnet because it has this degeneracy. But it say, okay, yeah, but somehow this degeneracy comes from something weird that we did with the Hilbert space. This is how people was interpreting it. It's an artifact of the math that we put in. And it was completely forgotten. Until 97, when the genius of Alexei Kitaev revived this stuff, okay? And they said, so let me show you two things. First of all, I can have a gauge theory emerging from a physical theory. So I will write down a physical theory in spins. And two, there are some, when we make it physical, then we see some amazing properties that in the gauge theory we cannot even probe, because in the gauge theory we cannot do anything to our gauge symmetry. You know, it's there, it has defined a Hilbert space like that. So what did Kitaev do? Was at the beginning something very simple. So he said, oh, first, my Hilbert space. My Hilbert space is just my total Hilbert space. Okay? So now we have the Hilbert space of all the spins. There are no weird gauge symmetries in which we identify states. If we flip one spin, or if we flip four spins, we get another state. All the states in the computational basis are there. Okay. So now I must write a Hamiltonian for the total Hilbert space. And what he did was to write the Hamiltonian of the gauge theory. And then he adds a term. And he adds, as a term in the Hamiltonian, what used to be our gauge transformation. So somebody yesterday asked me why we do not put this term in the Hamiltonian when we do the gauge theory. Well, we could have done it, but it does nothing, right? Because in the gauge theory, an has the value 1, always, for every n. So it's just like adding a constant to the Hamiltonian. We're not doing anything. Adding a constant to the Hamiltonian doesn't change any physics. But now, we are in the total Hilbert space. So we are not constraining ourselves to the states such that this is true. We are not doing that. So an can take different values. It can take plus 1 or minus 1. So since it can take different values, then I can put it in the Hamiltonian. So for g equals 0, my Hamiltonian is telling me I count how many times my b has an eigenvalue minus 1, and I give to it an energy plus j, and how many times my an have eigenvalues minus 1, and I give to them an energy plus u. So for g equals 0, the ground state energy, when everything is plus 1, will be equal to minus L squared, this is the number of sites and plaquettes that we have, u plus j. Okay. And then he said something very, very simple, and it's not that people didn't know that. He said, look, if I choose u much larger than j and g, okay, much larger than j and g. So you see, every time psi has an expectation value that is not plus 1, I pay an energy of order u. Right? So let's consider the space at low energy. So the energies that are much below u. Well, then this must be this space. Because every time I don't do that, I pay energy of order u. But what is this? This is the Hilbert space of the gauge theory. So he said something very simple. He said, with this choice and with this Hamiltonian, the low energy sector of my physical theory, because it's the theory of spins, is my gauge theory. Okay. So it's a way of making a gauge constraint emerge as an energy constraint. So the difference between energy constraint and a gauge constraint is subtle. The energy constraint means in order to see some degrees of freedom, you need a certain energy. So below a certain energy, you don't see them. The gauge constraint says those degrees of freedom do not exist. But at low energy, you don't know. You don't see them because they don't exist or because you are not at high energy enough. But this is a philosophical question. What you know is that the theory is the same at low energy. But there is a difference, and the difference is that now we can think of going at high energy and violating our constraints. Now we have the full Hilbert space to play with. So now we can address some questions more properly. Okay? So notice then that for g equals 0, the ground state is exactly the ground state of the gauge theory. It's again all the a equal 1 and all the b equal 1. So it's fourfold degenerate exactly as before. And then we have this problem of correlation functions. Okay? now I can think of perturbing my Hamiltonian either with this term, or I could even perturb it with this term, or with both, with any local operator, right? So I can write here lambda sum over L of some operators O L. Well, let me call them VL. Now I don't care whether these perturbations respect the gauge symmetry or not, because we are in the full Hilbert space. So in particular, VL does not have to commute with anything. Does not have to commute with our X gauge constraint, does not have to commute with our B term, does not have to commute with anything. Can be a random local operator that does not have any symmetry. Okay, so now we can readdress more properly our question about the splitting of the ground state and of how these local operators connect the two different ground states. Okay? So, for G equals zero, we know that for G equals zero, the ground state is exactly that of the pure gauge theory. So we know that the only operators that connect the two ground states are the W operators. So when I use omega I and omega j that are local, they're based at I and j, omega I times omega j cannot be one of the W operators. And therefore, alpha is equal to zero. This is for G equals zero. At the same time, we know that the degeneracy is exact. The delta E between different states is zero. Yes?
Can I clarify this again? Can I explain this again?
Sorry.
Why is that so?
Why this is so? What is the support of this? Yeah, what is the support of this? It's I and j, right? Order one. So they cannot be the same operator. Okay. So one is local, one is non-local, so they cannot be the same operator. So this is true at g equals zero. I'm calling this thing lambda, okay? Lambda. At lambda equals zero. Okay. So this special point, lambda equals zero, has these features. Okay, you have an exact degeneracy, and all correlation functions are exactly zero. But what about the whole phase, right? So this is very symmetric, right? These are just commuting operators. Everything commutes. Now, let's switch on lambda. And this lambda breaks all the symmetries. So we now see that whatever we find is in principle very different from the quantumizing model or from symmetry breaking. Because we know that in the quantumizing model, if here I put a field along Z, if I break the Z to symmetry, everything is lost, right? My degeneracy is lifted exactly by the term. I have a unique ground state. My long range order goes away, my long range fluctuations go away, everything collapses, right? Because it becomes a state with a unique ground state and a gap. Yeah?
Can you explain again, like, why does this imply that alpha equals zero?
Because the only way for this expectation value to have a value of alpha that is different from zero is if it alpha is the coupling of O between psi 1 and psi 2. It's the off diagonal element, exactly like sigma z. You see, I brought you the off diagonal element between psi plus and psi minus. So, but we know that the only operator that has non-zero off-diagonal elements between psi plus, so from zero and one, is W. And this cannot be W, so we're done. So this is the logic. Okay, so this is at lambda equals zero. Now we switch on a perturbation. We know that in the symmetry breaking case, if this perturbation breaks the symmetry, then I lose everything. I'm lost. Okay, I lose order, I lose fluctuations. Okay. Now let's do the same. Let's put a random perturbation that breaks all the symmetries of this system. You see, I even have a B that depends on L. So it breaks translational symmetry, definitely breaks these symmetries, does not commute with them. So it breaks everything. And now perturbation theory, according to your colleague, would tell us that we expect that there is a splitting. Notice that the splitting between different ground states, I don't know if you remember in perturbation theory, so this is my perturbation. And here I have two different ground states. Okay. You remember that the splitting between the ground states goes like this guy. Right? So this is perturbation theory. So you see that in order to have a splitting, I need this thing to connect psi 1 and psi 2. Or in other words, this operator must have off diagonal elements between psi plus and psi plus. Okay? So it's actually the same problem. Whether we have long range correlation functions or we are able to split the degeneracy between psi plus and psi minus, sorry, is the same problem. Okay, so we can refer to this one for the sake of simplicity. So what we need is this operator to have non-vanishing expectation value between psi 1 and psi 2. However, VL is a local operator, right? So again, each of these, the sum goes out, right? Will not connect the two exactly for the same reasoning that we said before. So this correction, this splitting is zero. So can I conclude that therefore there is no splitting at all, or I'm showing something under the rug? Please.
You're just going to first order in perturbation theory.
Speak louder, please.
You're going in first order.
A different order in perturbation theory, right? Because this is first order of perturbation theory. And what does the second order in perturbation theory tell us? Well, you have something like this square. Damp chalk. Okay. So in second order of perturbation theory, you would have lambda square. Then you would have the sum of L and L prime. Then you would have psi two, and you would have operators of this type. Right? But this is again local. So again, I cannot connect these two states. But how local is this? If our volume and range are bounded by number r, this is 2r, right? It's 2r local. Well, and the n-order in perturbation theory, I would have lambda to the n, then here I would have a long sum, and here I would have the product of objects that have this form, that now are n r local. So you see that when n r is equal to the length of w, which is L, then I can actually connect the two states and split the ground state and have correlation functions that decay like the splitting, because it's the same thing. The splitting and the off-diagonal element behave in the same way. So at what order this happens? At N equal L over R. And the splitting will be of the order of lambda to the L over R. So for small lambda, right, because we are perturbing, we have a finite range of lambda. Of course, if lambda is too big, we can have a phase transition. We change phase. But for lambda smaller than one, say, this is e to the minus L over R. Now, R is a finite number. It's the locality of our model. And L is the size of our system. So in the thermodynamic limit, this is zero. And this is amazing. Because when we break a symmetry, we open a gap. And we destroy long-range order immediately. And the thermodynamic limit doesn't come. But for a thermodynamic system, or even a fairly large system, in a system with 20 spins per side, you don't do anything. You perturb, and the ground state doesn't care. You make superposition of two states, and you do not create a long-range fluctuation. So we have a degeneracy, but the different ground states are not connected by local operators. So they are separated. So that's why they behave as if it was a paramagnet, because they don't know the existence of the other states. They cannot be connected by local operators. But it's not a paramagnet, because I have a degeneracy. So you see, this is a new kind of order. It's a new kind of order that is not symmetry breaking, because this order cannot be destroyed by breaking a symmetry. Does not depend on symmetry. This order depends on the fact that the Hamiltonian commutes with some topological operators, and therefore it's called topological order. And so not only Kitaev realized that this thing, that in the toric code, and there were around the same time, maybe a bit before, similar conclusions from the study of fractional quantum Hall effect by Xiaogang Wen, who was a faculty here and is still a frequent visitor here at PI, that this degeneracy is robust. Okay? There are some other features that are very interesting. But before going to these other features, let's go back to our old problem of having Schrödinger cuts, right? We know that going from here to here involves some global operation, and therefore one can imagine that this could be forbidden by some statistical mechanics argument that I never said what it is. But at least we know that going from this to this, I have to make many operations at the same time. And this doesn't look very feasible. So we have an intuition of the fact that this could be forbidden. And although I didn't tell you why it is forbidden in some cases, I told you that we do use it. All your electronic devices that have, a solid state hard drive or a flash memory, they all work thanks to this. However, so you see, this relies on symmetry breaking. But the same strength of symmetry breaking is its bane when we talk about coherent superpositions of these states. Because the same fact that tells us that going from here to here is global implies that going from here to here is local. It's just sigma z on one spin. And this fact is the same that this takes a non-vanishing value in these two states. See, these things are all the same fact of symmetry breaking seen from different angles. So the only way we used to know how to protect information guarantees that this, the quantum part of the information is easily lost. And this explains also why we do not see Schrödinger cuts. So you remember all this discussion. However, now we have a completely different mechanism. Now we have different ground states that are not based on symmetry breaking. Not only psi 1 and psi 2 are only related by W, but this is true in every basis. Also psi plus and psi minus are only related by some other W. So this is what is very interesting here. In every basis, you have a topological operator that connects different states. There is no difference between this basis and this basis. So if we are able to protect one, we also protect the other. Or at least it's not automatically doomed. Here it is doomed. If you can protect this, then you must destroy this. But now these two things are on the same footing. So that's why topological order is considered the ideal bedrock for creating a quantum memory or a real Schrödinger cut. And we've done that. Well, it turns out that theoretically, yes, because we can show that the toric code in four spatial dimensions, four, has this property. We can protect the qubit. Unfortunately, we do not live in four spatial dimensions. And when we talk about statistical mechanics, this is exactly like that. Because you can study string theory and you can think that you live in 10 spatial dimensions as long as some of them are compactified, right? So they're small, right? That's why we don't see them. But the whole point of statistical mechanics is that we do not care about what is small. We want these spatial extensions to be sent large. So we only have three statistical, spatial dimensions. we have only three ways of sending L to infinity. So there is something special about L, about three. Okay, so can we do that in less than four? We don't know. Okay, so we have some partial results, but this is an open problem. This is a very nice problem for a PhD student. It's very hard, but there are even not a complete solution. This problem is a very interesting advance, and there have been some advances. And in fact, one interesting advance was made by a student of Psi in his Psi essay and was published a few months later in Annals of Physics. So this is a nice type of problem to work on. Okay, so what are the other interesting features apart from what happens in the ground state? We now want to look not just at the ground state, but the excitations above the ground state. So let's study the spectrum of this model. And we will see that the excitations above the ground states are extremely interesting. Okay. So let's first look at lambda equals zero. Because here the model is exactly solvable. There is also a way to solve it exactly for lambda different from zero, but for a specific form of these operators, VL. But that's a bit complicated. So let's study the model lambda equals zero. So we said that E zero, the ground state energy, is this one. And the ground state is the span of our psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, psi 4. Remember that this is W1 psi 1, this is W1 psi 2. Sorry, psi 1, W2 psi 1, and this is W1, W2 psi 1, right? So they are all related to the first one by applying some W operators. What about, and psi 1, sorry, psi 1 is the state where all the AI are equal to plus 1, and all the bi are equal to plus 1. Okay? What about the excited states? Well, the excited states, as we said, are obtained by placing some minus 1s around, just like in the gauge theory. Only now, I need to decide if it's the B's or the A or both. So we have B excitations and A excitations. And they're called the charges and vortices, Z to charges and Z to vortices. And depending on the authors, they call vortices that of B or those of A. Doesn't matter. The model is completely self-dual in A and B. If you, at lambda equals zero, if you change lattice to the dual lattice, A moves with B by sending X in Z and Z in minus X. Okay, so the ground states are of the form we put AI equal minus 1. Then we need to put AJ equal minus 1. We need to do it in pairs, remember? And then we can put B1 is equal minus 1 and BK is equal minus 1. Okay, so this is some excited state. Of course, the spectrum looks like this. So this is the ground state. It's fourfold degenerate. Then we have this gap that is 4j. And we have here we have all the B excitations. And then we have another gap that is for you, and we have all the A excitations. But once we have learned that none of the interesting properties really depend on the fact that A is different from B, right? It doesn't matter for our splitting whether at what energy scale we are. We do not even need, for you is this. We don't even need to separate these two bands, right? We can choose any value of U and J, they can mix. So for you much greater than J looks like this, but we don't need to do that. Okay. Now, okay, I have only 1 minute left. One can show, and maybe we show it tomorrow, or we talk about dynamics depending on your taste, that these excitations, so let me draw them as plaquettes because it's the plaquettes that have eigenvalue minus one or stars, or they always occur in pairs. Let me connect them by some string. Imagine there is a string connecting them. That I can explain later what this string is. So in this picture, excitations are endpoints of strings. And one can show that they behave statistically as bosons. Okay? One can show that. It's not immediate. I will show you maybe tomorrow. But that from a spin model you can have emergent bosons is not very surprising because spin models are made of operators that commute at the distance. It's a bit more surprising that you can have emerging fermions, although you have seen that when you are using the Jordan-Wigand transformation that you can map a bosonic system in a system of free fermions. However, the Jordan-Wigand transformation is a non-local transformation. Here, one can show that, forget about what happens here, it's not important. If I glue these two excitations together, and this is a local object, these two excitations behave like a fermion. In fact, from a gauge, from an emerging gauge theory like this one, we can make emerge as excitations all we want. We can make emerge all the possible types of particles, bosons, fermions, U1 gauge fields. Of course, we need not that Z2 gauge theory. Z2 is too simple. But by making the underlying lattice gauge theory complicated enough, we can make emerge anything we want. In particular, tomorrow I will show you that this thing is a fermion. Has any of you studying field theory heard about the word semion? Semion? Semion.
Like an anion?
No, it's simpler than that. Anion is complicated. We can have emerging anions here, by the way. But semion is something simpler. Semion is what happens when you have two particles such that when you take one around the other, this takes a phase. So this is a bit less than having a fermion, because a fermion is something like, if you have two fermions, you know that two particles are fermions if you take a phase minus one when you exchange, right? And it's a boson when you take plus one. Now, is it possible that each of these particles is a boson, so you do not get an interesting phase when you exchange this with this? And you don't get anything interesting when you exchange this with this? But if you take one of them around the other, you get a minus. This, then you say that the pink and the white are semions. And one can prove in general that if you glue two semions together, you obtain a fermion. And I will prove it to you. So you have emerging fermions. Okay, so we have learned several things. We have learned that there is a new kind of order beyond symmetry breaking. It's called topological order. It's based on the fact that there is a robust degeneracy that is of topological origin. We know that tunneling between these states is forbidden. We know that the low energy excitations are not only they can be anything we want, but they interact when at distance. This is in fact the effect Aronoff-Bohm. This is exactly the effect Aronoff-Bohm. And this is described, this cannot be described, this interaction, by a Hamiltonian, because Hamiltonian as the meaning of energy is interaction. We know that we cannot carry energy at the distance, right? Or we would violate relativity. However, you have studied analytical mechanics, you know that you can interact at distance if you have a system with constraints. And they can be described by a Lagrangian. So there is a Lagrangian, and that's why we still have Lagrangians and Hamiltonians, because the Lagrangian formalism can do more, can describe things beyond forces. So the Lagrangian that describes this type of interaction is called topological quantum field theory. And it is what was invented by Witten. What we don't know yet, well, beside the fact that I just said that and I didn't show it, and I will do it tomorrow, is that what does this theory look like, not in terms of these degrees of freedom, A and B, but in terms of the spins, of the physical degrees of freedom that are the spins. And we will see that this is what yesterday I called the quantum spin liquid, or a gas of strings again. So we will see how we can understand topological order as a string theory. So we'll do this tomorrow.